Micah chapter 1. We came to verse 9. We concluded with verse 9 talking about the area of the time of punishment, the implication that it's even going to come to Jerusalem's gate when Sennacherib would come down upon them and enter their land in 701. The implication is there. Verses 10 through 15, he mentions many cities, about 12 cities, several cities. The names of most of them literally imply omens, imply evil or ill against the nation. So he talks about declaring it. He says, don't declare it at Gath. This was an enemy city. They declared it to Gath, they would rejoice. Weep not at all, the house of Aphra, roll yourself in the dust. Now we talk about some of the meanings here of these lands. Gath means tear town. Don't cry at all in tear town. Aphra means dust town. So dust is used in mourning. You know, in the house of Aphra, in the house of dust, roll yourself in the dust. It says, pass away, you inhabitant of Saphir. Saphir means a glittering town, a glamorous town. Yet he talks about it passing away. Something that was so glittering and so glamorous, yet it was going to fall to shame. Having your shame naked. Though it was glamorous, it was going to be stripped and reduced to shame. The inhabitant of Zanan, which means the word there, or close facsimile, means to go forth. Zanan, go forth, and yet they won't be able to go forth. He says, having your shame naked, the inhabitant of Zanan came not forth, though the word of the name of the town means to go forth. So he's using contrasts. He's using these terms to illustrate the opposite in some cases. In most cases, in fact. He talks about bring forth the mourning of Beth Ezel. Beth Ezel means strip town. He says, he shall receive of you his standing. This was an adjoining house, literally. In this case, why did I put strip town there? Yeah, strip town it can mean, or an adjoining house. Verse 12, he says, for the inhabitant of Maroth waited carefully for good. Now, yet Maroth is the word Mara, which means bitter. And so in the town of Bitter, called Bitter, they waited for good. But evil came down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. So he's picturing a group of cities from north to south. Feinberg gives some information on this, so does Robinson, which I won't take more time to go through. But he's mentioning some of the names associated with these towns. Let me read it from paraphrased. I think he gives some of these names as he goes on to expound about it. Yeah, verse 11, he says, there shall the people of Shafir sounds like the word for beauty, led away slaves, be led away as slaves, stripped naked and ashamed. People of Zanan dare not show themselves outside their walls. Zanan meaning to go forth. They're not going to be able to go forth. Foundations of Beth Ezel talks about Beth Ezel, sounds like the word for foundation, or the adjoining house, are swept away, the very ground on which it stood. People of Mara, bitter, vainly hope for better days, but only bitterness awaits them. And he's using this play on words. The term lakish, meaning horse town, says, use your swiftest chariots and flee, O people of Lakish, for you were the first of the cities of Judah to follow Israel in her sin of idol worship. So he goes on, he uses these various terms, plays on words, puns on words, to try to point out that if Judah doesn't straighten up its ways, punishment is coming their way. And while Sennacherib scared them, Nebuchadnezzar did invade and take them captive. So that's basically what he's talking about, and you can go through and get all the meanings of those particular words. I won't require that on an exam. Verse 16 says, make you bald. Now, in Deuteronomy, baldness is forbidden.
baldness is forbidden in the book of Deuteronomy, but yet he tells them to make them bald. I think it's Deuteronomy chapter 14. They weren't supposed to shave their heads. Yet he says, make you bald, pull you for your delicate children, a custom and mourning of that time. Enlarge your baldness as an eagle, for they are gone into captivity from you. As a nation, as a people, mourn because you're going to go into captivity. So here you have captivity predicted. Remember, the book is to Samaria and to Jerusalem. He already is dealing with Samaria. Now he's dealing with what's going to happen to Jerusalem as well. Chapter 2. He deals with crimes against man. Crimes against man. Crimes against their fellow man. Verse 1. Woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds. How many times you go to sleep, does your mind race and you come up with all types of ideas? Hopefully not evil ideas. Hopefully good ideas. But how many times, you know, you lie down and you're able to sort of clear your mind of the racket, knowing when it's peaceful and quiet. You know, and many times thoughts come to me, good thoughts about sermons, when I'm sitting at Sabbath services. And, you know, I'm concentrating on the sermon, and he hits a particular topic or an idea that triggers something in my mind. Or when I think of somebody back home that has a particular problem or a difficulty or thing, I haven't written that person long. Something he said reminded me of someone back there. When you're quiet, when, you know, the solemnness, when you're constant, you're sitting there, you're listening to the sermon, but he triggers something else because of the quietness. You're forced to be there all week long. There's so many things going on. But when I go to bed also, I try to keep a notepad and a pencil down so I can jot down the evil I think of. So I can jot down the information that I think of at that particular time. And it is good, because if you don't, there have been times I went to bed and I thought, oh, that's a wonderful way of saying, that's a terrific, that's such a profound point, I'll remember that tomorrow morning. I'll get up in the morning and I won't even think of it for a minute, and I'll think, something I was really happy about when I went to bed last night. Now, what was that? I couldn't think of it. It was lost, and in many cases lost forever as far as whatever message I had to bring. So I'm trying to learn when I go to bed. Many times, before I go to bed, my mind becomes alert because my daughter's in bed, my wife's just gone to bed, and I'm sitting there for a little while in my office, study at home, and that's when my mind just floods with all types of ideas. And if you don't capture it, you're wrong. But here in this case, he talks about they work evil upon their beds. They plot and think about it. They can't even go to sleep without thinking of evil. When the morning is light, they practice it. Plan it in the evening, practice it in the day, because it is in the power of their hand, which tells you these people have the power on their side. Verse 2 talks about the greed. They covet fields and take them by violence, seizing property, taking land. They take them by violence and houses, and they take them away. So they oppress a man and his house, even a man and his heritage. Take away what a man has saved up, what he's built for years, planned to give to his family. And they sweep it away from him, seizing their property. So this was going on. Crimes against mankind. Verses 3 through 6 talk about they're going to go into captivity in the end. Verse 3 says, therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, against this family. It's a good indication that a family equals a nation. A family grown great equals a nation. Therefore, against this family. Obviously, they weren't just a family of 14. You know, Israel and his wife and their children. Or extended family, even more than that, with the handmaids and two wives and everything. Behold, against this family do I devise an evil, from which you shall not remove your necks. You're not going to be able to extricate yourself from it. You're not going to be able to get out from under it. Neither shall you go haughtily, for this time is evil. You're not going to be able to get out of it. There's no way you're going to be able to make it out of this punishment that's coming due to you. And he talks about in verse 4, in that day, so notice an end time reference, shall one take up a parable against you. The term in that day can apply to when he first reckons with them, and then certainly the dual
application in the end time. In that day, you're going to have your difficulties. You're going to be spoiled. Verse 5 says, therefore you shall have none that shall cast a cord by lot in the congregation of the Lord. This had to do with setting their own boundaries. Among your people, nobody's going to set your boundaries for you. Who is going to set their boundaries for them? Their captor, their enemy. Their boundary might be a little prison compound. At that time, you'll have nothing to do with saying where you go. You read the article by Denny McClain, or the interview with Denny McClain, former pitcher for the Detroit Tigers, the last 30-game winner as a pitcher in American baseball. It's very difficult to do to win 30 games. Most guys are happy to win 20 games. And back in, I think it was 68, he won 31 games for the Detroit Tigers. Also helped them win the pennant. I think he was the most valuable player. And I helped them win the World Series. I think he was the most valuable player and Cy Young winner, which is terrific. He got involved in drugs, drug dealing, thrown in jail. This was when he was about 38, in his late 30s after he retired from baseball, got into drug dealing. Paid buku money. You know, what he did with that money, who knows. But he got into drug dealing. Sentenced to jail. He described how it felt to walk into this jail cell, 10 by 12, and all you have in there is a little sink and a little toilet and a bed with just a very small mattress on a spring and no pillow. And it's dark. You don't see anyone. You don't talk to anyone. And you're there. And he just thought, God, what has happened to me? Many of our peoples, when they're taken into captivity, you know, where they took property from others, they're not going to have anything to say about where they go and what they do, but they're going to be restricted in where they can go. Somebody else is going to define their area of space after that. Verse 6 says, prophesy not, say to them that prophesy, they shall not prophesy to them, that they shall not take shame. Now, if I read it, didn't I bring that down? Yes. If I read it from the paraphrased, listen how smooth it goes. Talk about others will set your boundaries then. The people of the Lord will live where they are sent. That's how Taylor translates verse 5. Verse 6, don't say such things, the people say. Don't harp on things like that. It's disgraceful, that sort of talk. Such evil surely will not come our way. We don't want to hear the bad. We don't want you to tell us we're not good people. Then he says, O you that are named the house of Jacob, is the Spirit of the Lord straitened? Is God constricted? Are these his doings? Did God cause these problems? Do not my words do good to him that walks uprightly? You know, these words shouldn't hurt you. If you're living right, they shouldn't bother you if you're obeying. And notice verse 8, he says, even of late my people has risen up as an enemy. You shall pull off the robe with the garment from them that pass by securely as men averse from war. So what are they doing? Crimes against each other. The women of my people have you cast out, the widows. So they take from mankind even his cloak, which they weren't supposed to do. The women of my people, basically talking about widows, have you cast out from their pleasant houses. From their children have you taken away my glory forever. You've picked on the widow and the fatherless, the most helpless people in the sense of looking at it from a human point of view, the widow and the fatherless. You didn't look after the needy, but you took advantage of them. God didn't like that. The answer, of course, in verse 7 would be Micah's answer to them. And they said, don't prophesy against us. And Micah said, wait a minute now, what do you have to worry? Aren't my words good to those that are walking uprightly? Why should they bother you if you're walking uprightly, if you're obeying? Notice verse 11. If a man walking in the spirit and falsehood do lie, saying, I will prophesy to you of wine and of strong drink, he shall even be the prophet of this people. So if you have some false prophet coming, here's what paraphrase puts it. I'll preach to you the joys of wine and drink. That's the kind of drunken, lying prophet that you like. Someone that's going to prophesy to them of it's okay, so you little white lies. So you get drunk once in a while. Everybody needs to get drunk to forget his problems once in a while, doesn't he? Don't they? We all need to get drunk once in a while. That's no problem. One person had mentioned to my daughter, this was before she came to college, you girls haven't done very much. There's nothing wrong. You don't have to live under this restrictive authority of your parents. And they didn't realize my daughters choose. After the teaching, they still have to choose that I can't follow them around and be responsible for them every minute of every day. But they saw right through the person who was trying to give them this wonderful sage advice. If you've never done it, try it. If you've never, smoked, try it. If you've never, gone out and lived it up a little bit, try it. If you've never gotten drunk, try it. Experiment. Try some things in life. I told my daughters, I said, you should have told him. Have you ever been a homosexual? Try it. You ever committed suicide? Try it. He wouldn't have liked that too well, would he? But I was so mad. I was about ready. They said, Dad, don't worry about it. I was going to call the person because I know the person. And not well, but I know him. And I was going to call him up and say, I don't appreciate you saying that to my daughters, but they're wiser than the guy was. He was a lot older than they. And they just said, Dad, we know, just full of hot air, spouting off his thoughts. Don't worry about it a thing. We know right where he's coming from, and we know what we're going to do. So I was proud of them in that way, but the idea, you should try this. You've lived such a restrictive life. You haven't done much in life. And if you haven't done evil in life, you've got to try a little evil. If you haven't lived riotously, sown any wild oats, you should go sow some wild oats. You can say, I sowed wild oats. And if you escape without getting trampled by the horses as they go for the oats, you're all right. Ridiculous type of thinking. They want someone who's going to preach to them what they want to hear. That's the idea of verse 11. Verses 12 and 13 then talk about a millennial inset. He says, I will surely assemble, O Jacob. Remember, Micah speaks as like a local elder of the people, one who really cares. He said, I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of you. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together as the sheep of Bozrah. This was a town well known for sheep raising. Well known for sheep raising. I'll put them together as the sheep of Bozrah, which they would have been taken care of. The prime area for raising sheep. As the flock in the midst of their fold, they shall make great noise by reason of the multitude of men. They're going to be rejoicing. They're going to be thrilled. They're going to be happy when they come back together. Verse 13, the breaker. Breaker is one who clears the way. Not clear who they're meaning. Could be Elijah. Of course, Elijah was to come and prepare the way for Jesus Christ. Or it could be Jesus Christ himself coming to clear the way so that Israel could come back. The breakers come up before them. They have broken up and have passed through the gate and are gone out by it. And their king shall pass before them and the Lord on the head of them. You know well from Ezekiel 34. You know that king is going to be David, whom God is going to raise up, resurrect to be over them. Let's see, Ezekiel 34 and verse 23. David shall be their shepherd. David shall be the one who looks after them, that God is going to raise up in those days. And also, certainly, God himself. It says, and the Lord on the head of them. So perhaps the breaker does refer to one who prepares the way, such as this work, the work of Elijah, the work of John the Baptist, the work of Mr. Armstrong, the work that Mr. DeKotch is carrying on doing. One who's preparing the way before that time. Perhaps the work of the two witnesses as well to prepare the way. But David, their king, and the Lord shall lead them. So verses 12 and 13, inset. Chapter 2, dealing with crimes against their fellow man. Chapter 3, anybody need to take a break? If you planned... I just barely got to class and I'm sure looking forward to that break so I can go, I'll give you a break. 1 minute. 1 minute. Okay? Everybody stand, stretch, or do what you need to do. the second natural division in the book. Second natural division. And here we find he's indicting the people. He primarily indicts here the rulers, the prophets, and the priests. He does not indict the military men. Does not. Underline. Capital. Okay? Just in case it happens to come on an exam, right, about this. Whom does he indict? The leaders of the nation. Now, maybe they're military men and the leaders, but he does indict the leaders. He indicts the ministry, the priests and the prophets. And we might want to note verses 1 through 4. I'll try to pick out a few verses as we skim along now. And I said, hear, okay, the second natural division, hear you. I said, hear, I beg you, O heads of Jacob, you princes of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know judgment? Shouldn't you be smart enough? Shouldn't you be wise enough? Shouldn't you know judgment? Of course, we know the justice has been forsaken. Many judges are corrupt. Of course, part of the problem finding someone for a Supreme Court judge is that some like men on there who are liberal, some like them on there who are conservative. And President Reagan's trying to get conservatives on there because he stands for law and order, and Congress doesn't want these guys. I mean, you imagine delving into their personal lives so much. I would ask, how many of you guys should be in Congress? How many of you guys in Congress? Let's interview every one of you now. Let's turn the tables on you. Have you ever taken drugs? Have you ever smoked cigarettes? Have you ever gotten drunk? You're not worthy to be in Congress. Have you ever committed adultery? You know, put them a lie detector test so they can't lie out of it. Any of them fail it, kick them out of Congress. Now, it's double standard. Like, and I don't say Ginsburg should have been in there, but it's like, you have done wrong. Therefore, you're no good now. And like he said, nobody even asked him how he did in his courts. Nobody asked him how his judgments were. He made mistakes, but maybe those mistakes helped him to be a better person now. But nobody wanted to dig up his past. It's because they want somebody, and now they said this new judge is more of a swing man. He votes for, you know, whatever the case seems to be. He doesn't just vote conservative, or he doesn't just vote liberal. He's sort of a swing man. He goes according to the case. It is sad. It is sad if you have enough money. If you have enough power, if you have enough prestige, many instances you can get off in judgment. Sad. Not the way God is. Is it not for you to know judgment? Shouldn't you be wise enough to know and make good decisions? Verse 2, who hate the good and love the evil. And that's exactly the opposite of what we should do. I guess Romans 12 and verse 9 says we should love the good and hate the evil. Just the opposite of the way mankind and human nature is. Who pluck off their skin from off of them and their flesh from off of their bones, who eat the flesh of my people. They consume my people. He's saying they are stripping my people bare. The leaders were consuming the people of Israel. They break their bones and chop them up in pieces as for the pot and as flesh within the cauldron. They ruin my people. They consume them. Verse 4, then shall they cry to the Lord, but he will not hear them. He will even hide his face from them at that time. Why doesn't God hear people? Why won't he? What stands between them and God? Why? Sins. Isaiah 59, verses 1 and 2. Why doesn't God hear? Because sins separate you. And though they may see their wrongdoings, they don't really know how to truly repent and won't. Paraphrase puts it this way in chapter 3. He says in verse 4, and then you plead with the Lord for his help in times of trouble. Do you really expect him to listen? Do you really expect God to listen when you're doing evil, when you're chewing up the people of God and spitting them out, when you're boiling up them up, when you're devouring them and consuming them? Do you really expect him to listen to you when you cry out for help? He won't. Verses 5 through 8, he talks about the prophets. Thus says the Lord, concerning the prophets that make my people err, it's up to a prophet to reveal the will of God, not his own will, that bite with their teeth and cry peace, and he that puts not into their mouths they even prepare war against him. As long as you feed me, as long as you give me what I want, as long as you bribe me, I'll tell you what you want to hear. But if you don't, I'm going to prepare war against you. I'm going to pronounce war. I'm going to make trouble for you, is the implication. And of course, many scriptures on false prophets, Jeremiah 23, Ezekiel 13, about those who lie to the people. They lie to them. And unfortunately, people who are not sincere love to have it so. Verse 6, therefore night shall be to you, that you shall not have a vision. It shall be dark to you, that you shall not divine. And the sun shall go down over the prophets, the day shall be dark over them. Their divining, their sorcery and magic is not going to work. God's going to confound them. They're certainly considered in the category of leaders of the country. Remember, love takes correction and affection. When you correct somebody, when you correct kids, it should be both. Just correction's not enough. Correction and affection. Of course, Hebrews 10:31 tells us that those who are supposed to be doing the will of God and don't, that it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Verse 7 tells us that they will get no answer from God. But verse 8 tells us why Micah was successful. Verse 8, he said, but truly I am full of power. These men lack it. These men won't get any answer from God. But I am full of power by the Spirit of the Lord and of judgment and of might to declare to Jacob his transgression and to Israel his sin. The same thing that Isaiah 58 verse 1 talks about. Isaiah 58 and verse 1, where he says, cry aloud and spare not, show my people their transgressions, the house of Israel her sin. Cry aloud. He said, I'm full of power. I'm willing to stand up. I'm willing to tell the peoples of Israel, both Judah and Israel, their sins. Verse 9, hear this, I pray to you, you heads of the house of Jacob, that and princes of the house of Israel, that abhor judgment and pervert all equity. They build up Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. So the land was filled with crime, violent crime. And we have no idea, you and I have no idea, how many individuals are bumped off in the world, are killed, are silenced by those in power. We have, even in our democratic world, we have no idea. We know it happens a lot, but we have no idea to the extent. Some movies have been made about those who had knew too much in the Central Intelligence Agency, and they had no need of them anymore, and they had to wipe them out because they knew too much. We know of individuals, what is it, the story where they were fabricating the trip to the moon. Is it Capricorn 1 or something with O.J. Simpson was in that, and they showed these three guys trying, you know, here they put them in the simulator, and one of the guys there noticed, hey, wait a minute, this signal's coming in really clear for them being so far away, and he noticed that it was just all a fabrication. And when he found out, they got rid of him, found his desk was closed up, he was gone. And then they had to get rid of these three astronauts who realized what they were doing was a fake and wanted to say something about it. It's an intriguing movie. Your own nation is against you. So we'd have no idea how much this happens in politics. We know it happens in other countries where dictatorships rule supreme, but we don't know how much it happens in our own country. You fill the Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. Verse 11, the heads thereof judge for reward, the priests thereof teach for hire. Of course, you're not supposed to take a bribe. The prophets thereof divine for money. Is it Deuteronomy 17, verse 11? Make sure I give you a proper reference. Deuteronomy chapter 17. In verse 11, he says, according to the sentence, the judgment shall not decline from the sentence that you give. So they are to show judgment in the land, verses 10 and 11. They are not to divine for bribes
We're to do it as ministers of God. We're to do it freely. We're to do it faithfully. We're to do it loyally. We're to do it without prejudice. He says, they divine for money, yet will they lean upon the Lord and say, is not the Lord among us? No evil can come upon us. We're God's people. We have churches. We go to church regularly. We study the Bible once in a while. We pray. We believe in God. What can happen to us? Therefore shall Zion, for your sake, because of you, is what he means, for your sake, because of you priests, because of you prophets, because of you leaders, Zion is going to be plowed as a field. We talked about that before. When you can plow a city as a field, you have nothing left. Become heaps, the mountain of the house, as the high places of the forest. I'm going to strip you bare. All right, chapter 4. Chapters 4 and 5 provide an encouraging section of Scripture. Vision of the kingdom to come, yet there are going to be troubles first. Verses 1 through 8 talk about the blessings that they're going to have, the vision of the kingdom. I need not go through this very thoroughly with you. You're familiar with these as some of the most oft-quoted millennial scriptures. Verse 1 talks about it happening in the last days, when the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established. But the mountain of the house at that time wasn't being established. It was being ruined. It would be torn down. But in the last days it shall be established in the top of the mountains. You might say the house. We talk about in England, you talk about the house of Windsor, the house of Stuart, the house of Tudor. So we talk about the house of the Lord, the family of God. That the mountain of the family of God, and we know a mountain is symbolic of a kingdom, that according to Daniel 2 and verse 35, and again in verse 44 of Daniel 2, that it is a type of a kingdom, that the kingdom of the family of the Lord shall be established in the top of all the kingdoms, and it shall be exalted above the hills. Of course, Jerusalem is built on a mountain. You have to ascend to get to it. And of course, you have the many hills on which Jerusalem was built. Mount Zion standing most beautiful. You have the holy hill of God, city of God. It shall be exalted above the hills. People shall flow to it. Notice, all people are going to flow to it. Verse 2 says, many nations shall come and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of the Lord. So this is millennial for sure. There are going to be peoples. You could use this to show there are going to be peoples at that day who don't know the law of God yet, showing these people can't be saints, because they're coming up and saying, teach us the law of God. They're going to come up to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways. We will walk in his paths, for the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Verse 3 talks about God judging. Not the way man judges. God will judge among many people, rebuke strong nations afar off. They'll beat their swords in the plowshares, spears in the pruning hooks. When mankind becomes peaceful, nation won't lift up sword against nation. Neither will they learn war anymore, so no more military academies teach men how to make war. When I took ROTC, a reserved officer's training class at college for 1 year, they showed us films. They taught us how to use weapons. They showed us how to take apart and put together, you know, machine guns and rifles. And we took rifle practice, and we learned to march, and we learned certain maneuvers and strategies that the military make one against another, one country against another. But they told us also that they quit using little square targets and started using targets in the shape of people, because they found the best marksmen among the Americans, when they would actually get out in the battlefields, and when you would see a human being, a body, an outline of a human being, they just couldn't shoot another person. So they had to take to making their targets in the form of a head and shoulders, so that you'd get used to shooting at a target that resembled the shape, the silhouette of a human being. So it wouldn't be so easy to make that transition in war. They also would show films of how the enemy would mistreat the Americans. Seeing a wounded American being stabbed to death. Captured film from the Japanese at that time. Captured film of the Japanese bayoneting some wounded American soldier to make you mad. So when you went over there, you were ready to kill. I watched a little bit last night. WGN had on Missing in Action Part 2 with Chuck Norris. I'll tell you, I have come real close to hating people when you see what they supposedly did to him over in Vietnam and did to the others. You know, the type of the missing, the POWs, the missing in action, and how they mistreated them and abused them, lied to them, how they burned this one guy alive who was dying of malaria. They gave him a shot of poison, and rather than wait for him to die, they put him out on a raised platform, put gasoline. Chuck Norris is standing and saying, "No, he's still alive." No, and the guy poured gasoline all over him, leader, and lit a match. And you know, about that time, you're saying, "I can't wait for Chuck Norris to get this guy," because it stirs you up. But I'm just saying, the military academies that teach people to hate, that teach people to kill, whose whole aim is teaching them how to make war and how to make it right. Verses 4 and 5 talk about sitting every man under his vine, under his fig tree, a symbol of peace. In Solomon's day, it was a type of peace. None shall make them afraid. I think it's 1 Kings 4:25 shows it occurred in the days of Solomon. It was a time of peace and plenty. None shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it. Verse 5, I'll conclude, says, "For all people will walk every one in the name of his God." And I've heard various translations, I'm saying, they're going to walk in my name. Boy, when I'm a God in the God family, everybody's going to walk in my name. I doubt that. You better be turning them to the Father. You better be turning them to the elder brother, not to you. They're not going to walk in the name of Gary. They're going to walk in the name of God. Check the literal translation of it. My margin says, literally, "All the peoples do now walk in the name of their God, but shall walk in the name of the Lord our God forever." They walk in the name of their God now. All peoples literally walk in the name of their God now, but we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. And I'll stop there.